Welcome to the Science of Psychotherapy podcast with your hosts, Richard Hill and Matthew Darlitz.
Hello and welcome again to the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. My name is Matthew Darlitz. I'm a filmmaker and I'm here with actor Richard Hill.
My goodness, what happened to the therapists? And we've disappeared. No, but that's their history. And yes, besides the fact that my old acting thing, but your Perfect Studios,
yes,
is of course energized by you and your rather brilliant cameraman, cinematographer son, doing wonderful work, putting together videos for all kinds of organizations, but also for training programs. And no better example than my Mirroring Hands training program that we've got on the Academy.
That's right.
So do check that out. But going on now back to perhaps a little bit more of the other side of things.
Our other life. So, Richard, we're going across to New York.
We're going to see a dear friend of mine, Dr. Debbie Joffe Ellis, who is the wife of Albert Ellis and is the current exponent of the wonderful practice of REBT, Rational Emotive Behavioral Therapy, which Al Ellis brought into it, and Debbie's continuing on. So she's going to tell us what it's about and where it came about and how it relates and all kinds of things, and then also just generally say good day to me because I haven't seen it for a while.
Okay, brilliant. All right, it'll be good to catch up. So let's go across to New York and say hi to Debbie. Debbie, welcome to the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. It's so great to see you.
Oh, it's such a pleasure to be here and to hear your Aussie accent, by the way, as you can hear, even though I've lived in New York City for close to two decades, my accent won't leave me, and that's fine.
Yes.
It's a pleasure to be with you both. Thank you.
And yeah, hi, Deb.
Listening or watching.
Yeah, and all the people all over the world, Debbie. It's, so here we are. So you and I have known each other for nigh on 15, certainly 10 to 15 years. I mean, I had hair that was one colour. But but it's beautiful to see you again and that you're there so comfortably engaged. Now, you're at which university? Columbia University? You're at?
In New York City, yes, I am. The very university that Albert Ellis, I have a hunch you're going to talk about him, the genius, brilliant, visionary pioneer of the cognitive revolution in psychotherapy. That's where he did his master's and PhD, but I'm probably jumping way ahead.
Well, only a little bit because, so to everybody in the audience, I'm speaking to Dr. Debbie Joffe Ellis, who was the extraordinary wife, colleague, and companion for Albert Ellis for as many years as it was possible for her to be so. But sadly, we lost Albert. How many years ago did we lose Albert?
Yeah, last July it was 13 years.
Yes, yes, it's been extraordinary. And you've been continuing the work. But, Matt, this is REBT, and we've got lots of questions about it.
That's right. So for those people that aren't aware, I was wondering if Debbie could just sort of give us a little bit of background.
Okay. I'll do my best to say a lot in a short time because I know our time is limited. So Albert Ellis was born in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, but his family moved to New York City when he was about three, and that remained his home base for the rest of his life. So he did a lot of travel, spreading his knowledge, wisdom, and approach. No time to give a detailed biography, but I'll start with the fact that he recognized when he was a teen, actually, that he had a gift for helping people. And because of the depression, he had to wait some years till he could afford, and really he couldn't afford, but he got scholarships to study at Columbia University. And he chose to be a psychologist. Now, at that time, Sigmund Freud ruled the roost. Psychoanalysis was really pretty much the only approach that one could get. And Al graduated and he was practicing for his early years under supervision, which is what we still do these days if we want a license to practice. And he found when he was working that even though some of his, they called them patients then. I prefer to call the people I work with the people I work with sometimes. because as I think you agree, patience implies a sickness and illness. So anyway, he saw that the people he worked with sometimes felt better after a session of psychoanalysis, but they weren't getting better. They weren't taking responsibility for their own emotions. And he didn't like that. And he often used to say he was born with a gene for efficiency. And he wanted people to get better, not just feel better. And so bit by bit, while he was continuing to practice his psychoanalytic approach, he became more active directive. He included some psychoeducation. And bit by bit, remember, this is just a quickie kind of description. I'm leaving out a lot. But he was writing, creating a lot of what went into his approach was based on the brilliant ways he learned to cope with his own adversities, which he suffered from infancy onwards, many of them being physical illness and pain, but there were others. So he was developing a very effective, humanistic, no nonsense, no BS, active directive approach, teaching people how ultimately to apply the approach to themselves, to be their own best friends, best healers, best therapists, if you want to put it that way. Teaching again people that they're responsible for their own emotions because he taught, influenced by Stoic philosophy and others, it's not events that create our emotional response and experience, but our perception of what we tell ourselves about them. And so bit by bit, he was forming, constructing, writing about. He had articles published in the early 50s. His approach, originally called rational therapy, then RET, rational emotive therapy, and in 1993, to reflect how holistic it is, it became rational emotive behavior therapy, the pioneering cognitive approach. A lot of people wrongly think that CBT, cognitive behavior therapy, notice it doesn't have an E in it, came first. No, in fact, my husband helped Beck. Beck acknowledged the influence and help that he, or inspiration as well, mentorship that he gave to Beck. Beck's work on depression, excellent work, came out in the late 60s. REBT was presented in 1956. And when it was at the American Psychological Association, Al was booed and jeered and called superficial because the therapists there were primarily psychoanalysts. But Al persisted. He practiced what he preached, that though it's nice to have approval, he didn't need it. And he wrote more articles. He kept on speaking and teaching. And over the years, more and more therapists, enlightened therapists, saw the wisdom of his ways. CBT came 15 years later, and there's what's called a so-called third wave of cognitive approaches. And from what I have read, each one of them, though a lot of them don't acknowledge the influence of my husband, has some elements of REBT. In conclusion of my answer to your first question, Aaron Beck and Marty Seligman, the father of positive psychology, to their credit, acknowledge the influence of Albert Ellis. And a lot of the other people on who stand on Al's shoulders don't. They sort of act like they invented the wheel. But that's okay. I mean, in the bigger picture, let's help as many people as we can, however we can. I just think there's something good to be said for integrity and just keeping historical facts accurate.
That's a beautiful frame, yeah. And it's certainly Matt. What's your response?
Yeah, well, I was going to ask you to sort of tease out this difference between REBT and CBT, and certainly, like you said, third wave does seem to be CBT plus the emotive thing tacked on. But
yeah.
But what you've just said in that very brief précis of the history of REBT is that it was the precedent. It sort of set the scene.
I think Sorry, Debbie, I was just going to say, just because this might give you a little bit more ground to run with, because my feeling was, and as I look at a lot of different examples of this type of prescient sort of work, is the ground gets smoothed. And certainly, as you say, when Albert was there talking about, as you say beautifully, Al, I can't bring myself, I don't know him well enough.
But what he did was...
That's right, that makes the difference. But he enabled, he made things like CBT possible. And we, you know, we think of the sort of stuff that when we look at Ericsson, who of course was we're all connected through. He also got a lot of booing and jeering along the way, and to some extent, even today, that disquiet in some circles comes through everywhere. But I think the other thing is that somebody said, and just the last comment that you might comment on was that. It might be said that Ehrenbeck had a little bit better political approach, and also the money that was required to develop the process was more flowing around that time, and Beck was just sort of there. So it was some, a bit of happenstance too that occurs in historic reflection.
Yeah. Well, to respond to that, Rich, credit where credit is due, and Al acknowledged the people who influenced him. And so, as I'd mentioned before, Stoic philosophers, Epictetus, as far as I know, first said it's not events but apperception of. And so, you know, and Eastern philosophies, and Alfred Adler, elements of his work as well, Bertrand Russell and others. So, you know, Al gave credit in his books and talks, and I attempt to do the same to the people who influenced him. So in terms of the differences between CBT and REBT, there are a few striking ones. The first one I'll mention is that REBT has greater emphasis than CBT on the E, on understanding emotions. Now, many approaches are not only cognitive, tend to bundle the positive emotions in one category and the negative and or unhappy and or unpleasant and or unhealthy emotions in another. But Albert Ellis went that much further. And he distinguished between the healthy and unhealthy negative emotions. And REBT gives clients and students an elegant, substantial, but in a way simple education that helps a person reflect, if they're willing, is my emotion helping me or hurting me? Is it healthy or not? And just really quickly, the healthy negative emotions that are part of the tapestry of life, which will, for most of us, contain some loss and suffering. And these healthy so-called negative doesn't mean bad in this context. It means not so pleasant. They enrich us. They're part of the tapestry of the privilege of being a human with the ability to feel emotions. So the healthy ones include grief. Gosh, I wouldn't want not to grieve when someone I love dies or a chapter in my life is over that I cherished. But grief is not depression. Anyway, the healthy ones, grief, sadness, disappointment, concern. That concern can motivate us. REBT doesn't want us to be complacent, namby-pamby, neutral zone. No, it wants us to feel. And some of these healthy negative emotions can motivate us. Healthy anger, when we witness or experience injustice. What makes it healthy is we don't react, we reflect, and we do the best we can to choose a reaction response, not reaction, a response, a behavior that hopefully does no harm and hopefully does some good, fighting for justice, for example. Huh? And the final healthy negative emotion is regret, that we take responsibility if we've screwed up, done something wrong, failed at something, and we realise we're not screw-ups or failures, but our behaviour was not that great. And regret helps us reflect and hopefully not repeat whatever we did. the unhealthy ones that debilitate us and can do more harm than good. And by the way, one of the things about REBT that also stands out is how holistic it is. And it acknowledges the inseparable interplay between not only our thoughts, emotions, and behaviors, but their impact on the physical body, the mind-body connection. So anyway, the unhealthy ones, depression, hopelessness, despondency, anxiety, panic, extreme fear, rage, guilt, shame. I'm sure in our short time, I don't need to elaborate on what makes them so unhealthy. So to go back to answering your questions, the education about emotion is greater in REBT. Secondly, the precision of disputing that REBT invites us to do after we've recognized that we're thinking unhealthy, irrational thoughts. One of the elements of REBT is when we think in irrational ways, we create those unhealthy emotions, not the circumstance. When we think in rational ways, we create those healthy emotions. So most, if not all, cognitive approaches invite us to replace an unhealthy belief with a healthy one. But REBT is that much more substantial because it says before you replace, zap the guts out of the irrational thought. Zap the life out of it by questioning Socratically, pragmatically, logically, where is the evidence? And so you dilute any credence in the irrational beliefs, and that increases the probability we can get out of thinking them habitually because we stop really believing them. And then we replace it with the new rational, healthy beliefs. The manner, the flavor of REBT, by the way, is realistic optimism. Not pie in the sky, it's all for the best. Sometimes things are not all for the best. But if we're still alive, we can find meaning in them, we can use them. So that's a second difference, the precision of disputing. Thirdly, and Beck agreed with this, REBT is more philosophical than CBT, but no less scientific. No less scientific, but more philosophical. Now, the thing you touched on as I conclude this, I'm sorry if it's too long, this reply to your question, Beck was associated and is, God bless him, he is still associated with the University of Pennsylvania, where you can get students and funds to conduct research. And one of the greatest contributions of CBT is the excellent research that it has done and is doing. And so that enabled that. Now, the good news for REBT is all the research I've read, now I've not read all of it, but a lot of it supports all the premises of REBT. No surprise there because CBT is based on the premises of REBT. Yeah. One of Al's, Dr. Albert Ellis, I said that for you, Rich, one of Al's greatest disappointment is that more specific REBT research wasn't done. Now, a good amount has been done, less nowadays. Now it's mostly focused on CBT. But in the 70s, 80s, 90s, quite a bit was done on REBT. But the reason more wasn't done, and Al wished more was done, was, as you indicated, the funds. Al just had a non-for-profit institute. There was a director of research, but Al was very disappointed that more research had not been done. Yeah, in conclusion, to repeat, the research, the evidence born from CBT research supports that in REBT.
Yes, I think this is an enormous aspect of difficulty that a lot of people struggle with. I know Ernie Rossi was great. Everyone who had a really good question, he'd say, "Fabulous, do a PhD. I'll supervise you. Get a lab." I think it's something that, just taking an opportunity here to slightly take a generalized comment, is that when we talk about evidence-based practice, there is a frustration and a difficulty of having a broad range of evidence being able to be found for a broad range of activities because it's so gosh darn expensive and so time consuming. Someone was saying the other day, I can't remember some of fairly high names, somebody said, why don't you do some research on this? He said, well, I just don't want to take a year off my life. This is not to say that we should now just sort of go off and madly grasp any therapy that's doing anything and or have any disparagement for things that are considered to have the evidence-based framework. But it's just something that we have to think a little bit more carefully about and do what you have just said. Not only look for the evidence that is specifically looking at a specific practice, but look at the evidence of things that are around it that point to it and give weight and volume to other things.
I think absolutely, absolutely. Because there is so much research out there, and it's just choosing, being able to identify that research which does substantiate, which backs up, you know, what you're doing in therapy.
More importantly, the proof is in the results of the people who practice it. So when people either do self-help, that's another gift of REBT, that unless a person has severe mood disorders or personality disorders, it's a brilliant, simple self-help tool, probably the first in psychology. Another reason Al was criticised, because a lot of the psychoanalysts of his time in the early part of his career really thought that their patients should see them on a regular long-term basis, and self-help kind of contradicted that. But anyway, one of the reasons that I do my best to present wherever I can, whichever country, city, a general audience, a professional audience, anything in between, is usually I found when a majority of people I speak to hear how simple the principles are and yet how they touch the head and the heart with a, oh, yeah. And when people apply, they see the results, and the proof is in the pudding kind of thing. Mm. And so research is important. Evidence-based approaches to give credence in the field, and by the way, then there's the whole thing of insurance. That aside, if we're looking at helping individuals, clients don't usually say how much research, doctor, has backed up your approach. They usually want help. And boy, can REBT help many people in a very short period of time. Again, some people with more serious issues require longer term, but they too can be substantially helped.
Yes, it's a very great brief therapy. It fits into that category quite often, absolutely.
Yeah,
but Matt, you've got that.
True. I was just going to say, I don't think I've had a client that's asked me for a list of research before they've entered into therapy. as you were describing REBT, one of the things that I've jotted down here was meaning making. Now, I know, you know, majority of therapies, we could say it's about meaning making. But the rational part that you were talking about, would it be fair to say that meaning making, from that rational element to the emotive element, is at the core of this therapy?
Yes. Yes. I love your questions. I love your questions so much, both of you. Yes, it is. And REBT suggests that we strive to gain meaning from, number one, thinking about our thinking, noticing, recognizing when we think in irrational ways, zapping them by disputing, coming up with effective new beliefs and repeating them often, ongoing effort, you know, neuroplasticity, if you want to change old habits, repetition, effort. There's that. And there's one vital element of REBT that I haven't mentioned yet, and I neglected to mention it when I replied to your question about difference between REBT and CBT, because it's another one of the main differences. REBT, more than any other approach I know in psychotherapy, emphasizes the importance and benefit of making effort to develop greater unconditional self-acceptance, unconditional other acceptance, and unconditional life acceptance. And it asserts that great enrichment and meaning in life comes from that. At the bottom of that is the understanding that every human has worth simply because we exist. Our behavior, good or bad, doesn't define our worth. What we have, how we look, our skills, they don't define our worth. That we exist defines our worth.
Yeah, this is this philosophical interaction, not separation from the theory, but an interplay within. And Matt and I mean, we vigorously advocate the thinking in systems, in the fact that we're a system where all elements are necessary for there to be that emergent result of recovery, of improvement, of change. And that, this meaning thing is unbelievably more important than people ascribe to. And we sort of denigrate it as being, navel-gazing or I don't care, just give me the money. And it pained our society to have these unsatisfactory attitudes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I would say the majority of people who attempt suicide do not have or feel that their life has much, if any, meaning.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's so vital to work on creating a meaning in life that is rooted in reality, but that stretches out to embrace the best of what being a human being can experience and create. And part of that is caring about and for other people and the planet. It's not just navel-gazing.
Mm. Yeah. Now, Debbie, are you seeing clients, able to see them? You've got your teaching, you've got your things, so you have a mixture of experience?
Yes, I do. Part-time private practice, and then I'm an adjunct professor at Columbia, so I teach there once a week. And I give a lot of presentations at other colleges, be it a workshop or a 5 or 10-part series. So I like to spread the word wherever I can, and I write as well. I've written some stuff. Recently, if I may say, give a plug to a book called This Will Shock You, Rational Emotive Behaviour Therapy, published by the American Psychological Association. It's actually the second edition that I wrote. The first edition my husband and I wrote, and it's a primer in REBT. And I love writing. I do an occasional blog for Psychology Today magazine, and that really lets me write for a general public, not just for people in the field. So, yeah, keeps me off the streets, as they say.
She sounds a tad busy, man. I think yes, she could come and join us somewhere.
All right. Well, we'll certainly point people to that book and resources, so if they want to know more. And I see on your website there's a bunch of things for people to explore there as well. I think we've pretty much covered the basics here, but we would love to know more. Richard, what do you reckon?
Well, I'm just thinking, Matt. I mean, we certainly will get we'll have Debbie on again, and we'll do some more stuff. But I would love to do some work like a workshop type experience, and maybe not. It'll have to be early next year because of all the things we're doing. Mm. But Deb, would you be agreeable to spend a bit of time with an audience next year?
It would be such a pleasure to do that with you, and highly irrational for me not to.
Absolutely. All right. So there's a promise for everybody. So any of our listeners who have some ideas of if they have some things that they want us to look at and cover, please just send us a note and we'll look at that. But I've actually got a couple of ideas. I'm going to talk to you about it afterward.
Yeah. I think this we should be exploring this more. I'm fascinated by this from the philosophical perspective. You know, you've got this sort of stoic influence, and you've got what keeps coming to mind is more of a Viktor Frankl kind of, meaning of life sort of aspect as well, nicely packaged into this therapy, which appreciates both the rational side and the emotive side.
Oh, there's so much more to explore, and it'll be a great pleasure. By the way, Viktor Frankl and Dr. Albert Ellis, for you, Rich.
Yes.
They were colleagues and really very friendly and had great respect and affection for one another. Not surprising, and there's much in common, both in Frankl's logotherapy and Al's and my REBT.
Yeah.
And to mention here that if you want, in a future conversation, I can say more about that. Like Viktor Frankl, my late parents endured 5 years in concentration camps and obviously survived. And they were not psychologists, but they found meaning in life and daily gratitude and hope, keeping hope alive. Would make things that sustained them and kept them sane and prevented post-traumatic stress in the years that followed. So just thought I'd add that.
Wow, that would be a great conversation on its own. Yeah.
So with that beautiful teaser of what can come forward, but gee whiz, you know, all that beautiful stuff about Viktor Frankl, all the stuff about life, about meaning, the history. I think there's both in what we've said, the gorgeous Al for your benefit, and so. But for now, I think Matt, we need to say goodbye.
We do. So, Debbie, thank you so much for joining us here on the Science of Psychotherapy podcast, and looking forward to doing more with you.
I'm looking forward to that too. Thank you again for having me. It's really been a pleasure, a great pleasure. Onwards and upwards. Looking forward to more work together.
Okay. Bye for now.
Bye. Bye. Oh, well, that was as much fun as I expected it to be. She's great. And knowledgeable. I mean, we just scratched the surface, of course, of all those things. And I think it will be great if we talk to maybe later on in December. It'd be really nice Christmas bonus to have a chat with Deb again.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And what a great idea. And I had no idea, actually. I have to admit my ignorance here. 1956, REBT was sort of established and preceded some of the CBT stuff that I probably know a lot better.
It's this surprising thing, Matt, that sometimes you go and look at something, and I certainly find this with my dear mentor, Ernie Rossi, that people say things and they say, we've just discovered this grand thing. And I say, my God, Ernie said that 40 years ago. What are you talking about? Still, people do come across things in their own pleasure, their own time. But we do need to acknowledge more. I think Debbie's got a good point.
Yeah, and I kept thinking, you know, she's talking about how it all works together. You know, I kept thinking about Viktor Frankl, and it wasn't that interesting how she said, you know, they were good mates too.
They were great mates. I mean, it was an era. It was obviously a mood of the era, and he was in that frame. So that's it for us, isn't it, for this week?
Absolutely. So thank you, everyone, for tuning in. Now, look, if you do like what we're doing here and you want to support us, you can always subscribe to The Science of Psychotherapy over at our academy. That's thescienceofpsychotherapy.net. You can subscribe and get a whole stack of, you know, our magazine and a lot of training material, and be supporting what we're doing, helping you as therapists stay up to date with the latest in the science of what you do.
Well, that sounds great. I'm signing up now. Brilliant.
All right. Thanks, Richard. Thanks, everybody. And we'll catch you next time.
Bye for now.
Thanks for listening to the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. For more great science, go to thescienceofpsychotherapy.com.